Welcome. This is Michael Munger, Director of Duke University's Philosophy, Politics, and Economics program. This lecture series is produced by the PPE program, and all the material in these lectures is the property of the PPE program. You are free to use these recordings for any educational purpose, so long as you give proper credit to Duke University and to the individual speakers in each lecture. The lecture series is sponsored by Duke University and by a generous donation from the Thomas W. Smith Foundation. If you have questions about the series or about the PPE program, please contact me, Michael Munger, at munger@duke.edu. And now, enjoy today's lecture. All right, well, welcome. Our speaker today is Dr. William Dugan, who has degrees from University of Virginia and University of Chicago. He has taught at Dartmouth College, University of Chicago, and for quite some time now has been at Clemson University, where he was the chair of the economics department. I first met him at the Federal Trade Commission in the first Reagan administration, the fall of 1984. The topic he's going to talk about today is one that's both important and timely, and one that he has considerable background in. So I look forward to his talk about the economist and the state. Bill.
Thank you, Mike. So this is my topic, more or less. It's a play on the title of a book by an economist named George Stigler, who got a Nobel Prize for this sort of thing, called the Citizen and the State. So my theme, more or less, is going to be the how economists grapple with questions of policy. So, but I forget to ask you, have you talked about the Coase theorem? Excellent. Well, now you don't have to. So I begin at the beginning. A branch of law that has nothing to do with regulation, the law of torts. Tort is a funny word that comes more or less from twists and turns, and it's the idea of a tort is someone's done you harm, and you seek legal remedy in some way. And for the longest time, law and economics operated in their own separate spheres, and policy analysis in economics consisted exclusively of economists telling the sovereign or the legislature how they could do things better. Most famously, for the purposes of my talk, the early debate in 19th century England over what were called the corn laws, which were a tariff on wheat imports, basically. That was the repeal of the corn laws was the first big policy breakthrough for professional economists. We just assumed, as a profession, that was our job, whispering in the ear of the sovereign. But the sovereign didn't have much to do with tort law. It's just a branch of what's called common law, in which you just go to a judge, and the judge decides what are the relevant facts of the case and who's going to compensate whom for the harm. And the key idea in law of torts is blame. I was once fortunate, I guess, enough to take part in a conference, which consisted of trying to teach economists some law. They brought in many eminent law professors, and they found us to be a hopelessly resistant group of students because we kept telling the professor why his arguments made no sense. Because in economics, the concept of blame is a very tricky notion. If my fist connects with your chin, no, most of us say it's my fault, but I could say, well, you didn't move your chin fast enough. You saw my fist coming. So in economics, we have a tough time, but this lawyers, not so much. So the key point is that when a judge assigns blame in a case, and this eventually becomes precedent, we don't keep litigating all the time, this implies some assignment of what economists call property rights. So I have the right to move my fist in certain ways, but if it comes in contact with your jaw, the general rule of law is, I'm to blame. I've committed a tort against you. So the question the economists like to know, because we talk about the allocation of resources, is, so how much influence do these judges, or does this common law have, on the allocation of resources, because that's our fundamental question. And again, for the longest time, the economists just assumed, well, obviously, if the judge holds for people with chins against people with fists, then we're going to have a lot less chin hitting than we would if people had the right to wave their fists anywhere. So here's a question that comes up a lot, surprisingly. I did a little search on this, and I was astonished at how much this is on people's minds. So I don't know if you can see this, but I'll go through it quickly. So this is from Yahoo Answers. My neighbor's dog, a pit bull, of course. It's always a pit bull, right? Gets out on occasion and runs into our backyard. The yards are fenced, but not real well. My children play outside. Yesterday, my 8 and 5-year-old son were stranded up on the trampoline. Cornered, I think, probably. While the dog barked, growled, and seemed to viciously want to bite me. I went outside, and the dog came after me. Exclamation point. I went and grabbed my gun, and went back outside, and the dog was gone. So on and so forth. This is the fourth time this dog has been in my yard. My favorite part of this whole thing is the final line. I'm hoping it's legal to shoot my neighbor's dog. I live in Texas. I'm guessing the answer is yes, but I don't really know. All right, but so here's a classic tortious incident, okay? This is a classic. Who's to blame? So what is this person to do? Well, you know, economists could have written many, many deep journal articles about this, or they could go to the most popular answer, which I find persuasive, call a lawyer and beef up your fences. And I think this pretty much says it all right here. Okay? So what's the point of all this? The point is, here we have a case where, suppose that it's not legal to shoot your neighbor's dog in Texas. In fact, Texas is a free-range state when it comes to dogs. So the dog's owner is not liable for harm, all right? Well, Yahoo speaks, and who are we to object? The best course of action for the neighbor is build a fence because it seems pretty cheap compared to wrap your kids in suits of armor or take them to the hospital every day or get rid of the trampoline, leave them inside, any number of things. The fence seems like the sensible thing to do. Okay, well, that's what you do. So suppose we're not talking about crazy free-range dog raising Texas, but we're talking about some nice refined state, such as some of you are probably from, Connecticut or something like that, where dogs just don't get to roam free, and dogs' owners are liable for the harm. What's going to happen then? Well, that brings us to this famous thing. A fellow named Ronald Coase, who didn't know he was writing down a theorem at the time, came up with the following conclusion. If building a fence is the cheapest way to prevent harm to the neighbor, that is, the victim in this case, the woman who posted the question, well, it's also the cheapest way to prevent harm for the dog's owner. So whether the dog's owner is liable or not, Coase says, well, they're going to build a fence. This last sentence is generally what's considered the Coase theorem. The assignment of liability does not alter the action taken to mitigate harm. Now, I don't know how you react to this, but I think you react in one of two ways. Possibly this. It seems impossible. How can this be? What if one of these people is really good at building fences and the other one is terrible at it? What if one of them has a brother-in-law in the business and the other one doesn't? What about all this? How can it possibly be that the fence costs the same amount to both parties? And well, the answer is pretty simple, really. If one of these people is super good at building a fence and they don't have the responsibility for building it, they can subcontract, they can hire themselves out to the person who does. Side payments, basically. Also known as Coasean bargaining. Which leads us to the subsequent view of the Coase theorem. It's obvious. I mean, this is pretty much the way all economic discoveries go. This is my law of development of history of thought and economics. In fact, the big trouble with this is that if your insight is so good that you win a Nobel Prize, when the Swedish Nobel Committee writes up the one paragraph simple English description of your work, you'll sound like an idiot, almost certain. It'll be something like, yes, Professor Buchanan gets this prize because he has pioneering work showing that politicians are self-interested. A person gazes upon that statement and shakes his head wondering what in the world is wrong with this field. But the fact of the matter is, for two centuries, economists thought their job was whisper in the ear of the king. They didn't think about any much self-interest. So we have this irrelevance result for the law of torts. Right, but the law of torts doesn't really work. We don't think it works very well for everything. In particular, the standard case being environmental pollution. So this dog isn't just terrorizing the next door neighbor. This dog is actually radioactive. And it's running all over the place, causing thousands of people untold harm. Now, they could all get together and threaten to sue the dog's owner. They could file some sort of massive lawsuit, or they could all bargain with the owner sequentially. They could all go to the trouble of building fences, but this starts to look very costly compared to the appealing alternative of just passing a law saying, hey, you just can't have radioactive dogs. We're going to set up a bureau which is going to test all dogs for radioactivity, and if your dog exceeds the threshold, it'll be removed to someplace like South Carolina, where nobody minds little radiation. So we have these basic antithetical approaches to dealing with harm, the law, tort law, and regulation. And an early obvious question that would come up is, well, we have this important irrelevance result for tort law. It doesn't matter who gets assigned the blame. And a reasonable question to ask is there a similar irrelevance result for regulation? So the first paper on this topic was by George Stigler, subsequent Nobel Prize winner, and his longtime research assistant, Claire Friedland, called What Can Regulators Regulate? It's a funny-looking title, but basically it's to ask, does regulation matter, or is it irrelevant in the way that the assignment of legal liability is irrelevant? Their answer was regulators can't do anything. They got this answer by looking at the onset of the effect of on electricity prices of the onset of state-level regulation. So they looked at the early days of the development of electric utility industry in the U.S., which were the early days of the development of electricity regulation. So at some point in U.S. history, some states had price regulation of electric power and other states did not. Anything went. The question was obvious, does this matter? Now, nowadays, you would never be able to nobody could publish an article like this, not even Professor Munger, because we'd say, well, the reason you get regulation is the prices are high, so when prices are low, nobody cares about regulation, so of course you don't find anything, but this is piffle. And it raises the important question, why, if regulation didn't matter, why would it not matter? And there are two possibilities. One of them is, well, competition is the ultimate regulator of prices. So, there's sufficient threat of entry into the electric power generating business, either by new firms or by firms in neighboring states, that we just regulators don't have anything to do. The prices are already as low as they can go. The other possibility is the exact opposite. Well, regulators are completely captured by the industries that they regulate, so there's monopoly power everywhere. So if they're unregulated monopoly, electric power monopolies, they charge monopoly prices. And if they're regulated, it doesn't matter because the regulators are wined and dined or bribed or persuaded or lobbied or whatever you call it. They're subjected to some sort of political activity that induces them to replicate monopoly prices. So, not the most satisfactory state of the world. We have some data, and we have two equally plausible explanations, and they're completely opposed. Well, you see what happens. We start thinking about this question, and we start wondering about regulators' behavior. I already had to discuss the possibility of regulators being wined and dined, but I think that's unfair to the regulators. I actually, one of the best things about having been at Dartmouth is I got to meet a fellow on the faculty of the business school who was a regulator. He was a longtime member of the New York State Public Utilities Board, or whatever it was called. So I get to talk to him fairly extensively about the life of a regulator. And in fact, he was a very honorable man. He wasn't looking for bribes or lavish meals, junkets out of town. He was looking for actual believable numbers on costs of electricity generation. So he wanted, like any regulator would, he didn't want to put the industry out of business because you don't get much electricity that way. And he didn't want them to run roughshod over the interests of consumers. He was a dedicated public servant, but he faced a very difficult problem, which is an information problem. When you think about it, you realize how tough it is to be a regulator. You need to know costs to know what a reasonable price is. Well, where do you get your cost data? You need to regulate an electric. You need to regulate the Duke power. No, I know it's going to be very light regulation, but nonetheless, you have to regulate them. And you're interested in the public good. You got to figure out what their costs of electricity generation are. Where are you going to go for those numbers?
The producers?
Yeah, great. Yeah. You got to go to the business itself. They control the information flow. So it can get very complicated to figure, and you'll know they're probably padding their numbers a little bit, and you want to discount their numbers, but if you discount them too much, that's not going to work out. No, it's a very difficult problem. So in everything else that I say today, I do not want to give the impression that I'm asserting that the entire process of economic regulation is corrupt in some sense. It's fun to talk that way, and Lord knows sometimes it is, but that's not essential to what I have to say. The thing that's essential to what I have to say is that the information needed to regulate is not freely available. It's not just hanging around on trees. It is itself an economic problem. Okay, so perhaps unsurprisingly, if you've gotten this far in learning about economics, you'll learn that do we get competitive prices out of regulation? Do we get monopoly prices out of regulation? Well, you know, the odds are we get something in the middle. Right? That's pretty likely, and a fellow named Sam Peltzman, who's the most successful student of George Stigler's. So that's two. The only other one I ever heard of is Thomas Sowell. Those are the three students I know who made it through Chicago under Stigler. Sam basically said, well, you know, it's a little of this and a little of that. Regulators answer to government officials. So if you want to understand the motivations of the regulators, they are simply what economists call agents. They're not the main actors. The main actors are the people who are their bosses. And in democratic societies, you have these legislative oversight committees. In authoritarian societies, you have el jefe, and you better please him or her. So if Peltzman pointed out, regulation is essentially a political matter. And this is how the Chicago boys, starting from the coast, very innocently, following this chain, or pulling on this loose thread, however you view it, found themselves in the land of political science, where nobody, as far as I can tell, meant to go there. It wasn't as if everybody said in Chicago, hey, you know, let's go colonize political science. In fact, I'm not even sure that many Chicago people were all that aware of all the work that was already being done. I think that's one of the reasons that there were some hard feelings among the Virginia people. When Chicago guys just sort of barged in and said, oh, hi, we're here now. We'll take over. A lot of people have been doing a lot of work trying to apply economic theory to politics. It just turned out to be very hard to do. And I think if I were going to make a claim for the Chicago approach to political economy, it would be we just cut the Gordian knot. And what the Chicago types do is just say, you know, there's a hard part of this problem and a not so hard part of this problem. We'll work on the not so hard part. All right. So we have the key point is at the bottom. The regulator / politician balances competing interests to stay in office. So we have this balancing act. So what does all this mean for policy advice? Well, here's where this is what I think is the true genius of this fellow Coase I've been talking about, and why he's always on my mind when I think about policy. We don't actually get to whisper in the ear of the king. And it's bad analysis that proceeds in the assumption that that's what we're going to do. The only thing we get to do is choose among institutional frameworks. Principally, we can allow private bargaining to work. We can say, you know, in the case of dogs chasing kids, we're actually not going to get the federal government involved. We're going to leave it to the neighbors to work it out among themselves. And that has a predictable set of outcomes. But, of course, we might choose to regulate. And if we do, then what we know now, what we learned is, we don't know whether regulation is better than private bargaining until we can predict the outcomes of both. It's not enough to predict the outcome of one, private bargaining, say, you know, this falls short of some hypothetical ideal I can imagine. In a world of, say, perfect information where regulators know exactly what costs are and what benefits are, and they will do exactly that. That's a false standard of comparison, and you can do untold damage to society by mistakenly thinking that's your choice. Because when you set up the regulatory agency, it's not going to be run by super geniuses. It's going to be run by ordinary people. And we have to predict what ordinary people are going to do when they're given regulatory authority to know whether we want to regulate or not. And that's the fundamental point. So the Chicago/Stigler/Peltzman story is sort of a Goldilocks theory. Regulated prices would be, they'll be higher than some ideal under free competition, but they won't be full monopoly. Why is this? Well, because there are three basic sorts of interests that these politicians and regulators are trying to balance. The demands of industry, which is for high prices and restricted entry of competitors. The desires of taxpayers, which is, let's find somebody else to pay for all this government spending. And the desires of consumers, who like low prices. In fact, consumers, in many cases, unless they're incredibly forward-looking, would be perfectly happy with prices that are below cost. So the Goldilocks theory has two implications. One, this not terribly helpful one, I think, that regulated prices would be somewhere in the middle. That's not, if that's all we had to offer, I don't think I'd have been invited here. Slightly more sophisticated implication of this is that regulatory policies will tend to cushion the effects of market fluctuations. So the world of free markets is a world of constant upheaval, really. Schumpeter called it creative destruction. CNBC calls it price volatility. Whatever it is, it's change. Things are always being buffered about. So one day we're sailing along with $3 a gallon gas. The next day we're supporting the rebels against Gaddafi, and the oil fields in Libya shut down. The day after that, we're opposing the rebels in Libya, and the oil fields are still shut down. And we got $4 a gallon gas, and you know, we didn't see that coming. Then that comes as a big surprise. And this Peltzmanian theory says people, when regulators have a chance, they're going to try to keep prices from rising as much as costs. And when costs fall, they won't let prices fall as far as costs. That's the basic idea. So here's my theory in a nutshell. Chicago theory of regulation, briefly stated, we take one healthy serving of Ronald Coase, we add practical politics, and we get the Peltzman theory.
When did Sam ever dress that well?
That's his official photo as director of whatever, the center for the whatever.
He usually wears a blue and orange plaid jacket.
You know, and I tried like heck to find one of those pictures. I really did, but you know, time is valuable. I was mostly happy about the Rahm Emanuel thing. And I put this up, and this is, of course, glib mostly, but not entirely, because when I look back on my days in graduate school, It would have been astonishing if Chicago people didn't come away with the view of politics they had, because it's what was in front of them every day. The sort of the daily machine was clearly a place where favors are being done and money is changing hands, and the idea that there's some sort of public-spirited, disinterested legislature choosing policy is just ludicrous on its face. You wouldn't have gotten 30 seconds in any discussion in the city of Chicago with that model of politics. To the extent where when I first was writing on this topic as a grad student, the term that's now called political influence in politics, I just called clout. It was a book by a fellow named Mike Royko all about the Daily One era. And it was pretty clear that's the way the world worked. Okay, so what does it have to do with the assigned topic of trade protection? Well, this is a pretty short leap. The Chicago people were originally fascinated by regulated prices simply because these people had been studying a field called industrial organization, which is all about non-competitive industries. It's a short hop from there to apply this very same theory to tariffs, because it's just another form of price regulation by the government, except it has a couple of interesting features that make it, in my opinion, a more interesting place to apply this theory. Now, number one, we have the government actually deriving revenue from tariffs, whereas the government doesn't derive any revenue from higher electricity prices or lower electricity prices. And this is going to turn out to be important in generating testable implications of the theory, which are always nice to have. And the other thing is that it gives us lots more observations. So a theory of electric utility regulation can only be tested on data from electric utilities. A theory of tariff protection, tariffs apply to thousands of goods and in all kinds of countries. Rich countries, poor countries, everything in between. Sometimes goods are imported by one country and exported by another. So as I'll show, we can compare import tariffs to export tariffs. Tariffs are levied at different stages of production. There are all kinds of things going on with tariffs that are not going on with public utilities, and so it occurred to me a long time ago that this was a pretty obvious way to not only to extend the theory, but to test it. Here's what I was referring to when I said we'll take the easy stuff and leave the hard stuff to political scientists. The political theoretical content of this Peltzman model is minimal. It's pretty much nothing more advanced than something really originated with a fellow named Anthony Downs in the 1950s. It was sort of codified by Mansur Olson in his 1965 book, The Logic of Collective Action. And it's nothing more than the insight that it's easier to get a small group to act cohesively than to get a large group to act cohesively. And that's a pretty basic point. But it turns out to be important if you think about political influence and lobbying. So if the ceramic tile industry is worried about import competition from Italy, there's only a handful of domestic ceramic tile firms. They already have an industry association that's worried about this, that, and the other thing. So it's easy enough for them to hire a lobbyist to go to Washington and explain. Again, remembering this information problem legislators have, to explain in Washington the vital national security interests at stake in ceramic tile manufacturing and why it's critical that this be located inside the territory of the U.S., because we do not want to be reliant on imported ceramic tiles in case of national emergency. That's the sort of standard argument that's made in Washington. I don't know if anybody actually believes it, but for some reason they feel obligated to make the argument. So we pretty much leave it at that. And that's leaving aside an entire intellectual field, political science, which goes into great detail on how political decisions actually get made. We leave that aside and say, well, you know, you're just going to balance stuff. So you look for some intermediate point. What our emphasis is going to be on is looking at observable differences in the constraints that face the tariff setter and making predictions off differences in observable. Have the semblance of scientific inquiry. That is, it makes testable, refutable, implicate predictions. It isn't just descriptive, because I will readily concede as description, it's not very interesting. So we ask, what are the main observable factors constraining tariff sales? Well, the first one, and I think in the early literature it did not get enough attention, is the revenue constraint. For much of U.S. history, the main source of revenue for the national government was tariffs. Anybody who was arguing for complete free trade and zero tariffs was basically arguing to put the federal government out of business. There's no way that was going to happen. The general level of tariffs was, as you know from U.S. history, was an ongoing subject of contention. Southerners wanted it low, and the North wanted it high, and the reason was the North wanted to protect its nascent manufacturing sector. The South wanted it low because the South was heavily involved in imports and exports. So the second force that constrains tariffs is other firms. So I talked about this Mansur Olson business about small organized groups dominating political considerations. Well, if I'm importing automobile parts and I'm called General Motors, I'm not too happy about a tariff on imported automobile parts. And I have a little bit of say. So we'd be very surprised if it weren't the case that tariffs tend to be higher on final goods because we don't think consumers spend much time complaining about the ceramic tile tariff relative to tariffs on intermediate goods. So we'll check this one out. And three is just the reason why two matters. Okay, so we have our first testable implication. Tariffs are generally higher on final goods than on intermediate goods. The evidence in this case is everywhere. There's even a term for this empirical phenomenon. It's sometimes called cascading tariffs, sometimes called escalating tariffs. But that's a common feature of tariffs. Everybody has a little table, which you probably can't read, but that's okay. It's just here to show you that there are data. So if you could read it, you would read it from left to right. We proceed by increasing levels of fabrication. So finished products, the rightmost column, raw materials, the leftmost. And in almost all cases, what you see is the tariff on finished products is a fairly large multiple of the tariffs on raw materials. In fact, you get a lot of zeros on raw material imports. These are from four countries that I picked because I could easily capture the table. The ultimate source is the World Trade Organization. Okay, so lots of zeros in the columns for raw materials. No zeros in the column for finished products. Semi-manufacturers, the intermediate goods, tend typically to be in the middle of the other two. It's not 100% the case, but it works pretty well as economic theories go. All right, so here's a prediction about a political outcome based on not much. That's my point, though. I didn't need a lot of theory here. I just needed Mansur Olson's simple point. And I apply it to, and then I just observe that intermediate goods are goods that are sold to other firms. And so the pattern there ought to look very different from the pattern for finished goods, which are just sold to hapless, unorganized consumers. And this pretty much holds up. And it holds up in country after country. These are developed countries, but it also holds up for developing countries. Okay. Another testable implication. Tariffs are more likely to be set for non-revenue purposes when electoral politics matters more. That's sort of by definition. And why is that? Well, the simple point is this. Suppose I am the absolute ruler of Libya, and what do I get out of this? Well, I get power. I have the pleasure of bossing people around. But also, I just presumably have claim to a lot of the resources in my country. And one of the ways I get resources is by levying taxes and tariffs and this sort of thing. And if I raise my tariffs to so high that they prohibit people from importing goods, I'm not going to collect any tariff revenue at all. If I set them at zero, I don't collect any tariff revenue either. So if I really want to get a lot of tariff revenue, I set my tariffs at intermediate levels. On the other hand, if we just have a bunch of voting going on and industry interests completely dominate, then the tariffs are going to be set very high. Or if consumer interests dominate, tariffs will be set very low. So we're going to see more extremes, says this prediction, in sort of democratic societies. The most flagrant example of this is the most infamous tariff law in American history, the Smoot-Hawley tariff. If you read the legislative history of the Smoot-Hawley tariff, you'll see the way the tariffs were set industry by industry was this, and it'll sound like I'm kidding, but I'm not. A representative from the industry would be called before the congressional committee and asked, so what tariff would you like? And the answer would be given, oh, I think we'd like 300%. Okay, fine. That's pretty much the way the Smoot-Hawley tariff was set. So how do you test this? Well, Jim Snyder and I tested this some time ago. And we just looked at countries that were kind enough to switch between democratic and non-democratic regimes. And we found that quite reliably, tariff revenues are higher under a non-democratic rule than under democratic rule. Another implication of this theory is if you're going to get consumers together at all to be roused, if you're some sort of political entrepreneur who wants to lead consumers to the promised land of free trade, the only way you're going to get this done politically is through across-the-board tariff reduction. Consumers don't spend a large share of their incomes on any one good. That's the beauty of being a consumer. So you don't really rouse yourself to worry about the ceramic tile tariff, because you just don't spend that much of your budget on ceramic tiles. But you do spend 100% of your budget on all goods, and a large share of that is spent on imported goods. And so if somebody comes up to you and says, well, let's not do this line by line, item by item, let's do it across the board, well, they might actually have your interest, and if they have your interest, then they might actually get your political support. In this case, the evidence is so lopsided in favor of this implication that it's useless to even put it up as a fake table. The GATT was a defunct thing called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which was set up in the aftermath of World War II. And the first set of, they would have these occasional rounds of negotiations. The first round was called the Dillon Round, after U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, Douglas Dillon, I think. And that was a complete failure, as far as I can tell, because they tried getting tariff cuts item by item. The next round was called the Kennedy Round, early 60s. And that was the first across-the-board tariff negotiations. It was quite successful. There was the Tokyo Round after that. Then we got the World Trade Organization replacing the GATT. The big difference, as far as I can tell, is that the WTO has a much bigger bureaucracy. So a lot more jobs for economists there, which is always important. So we've had the Uruguay Round, the Doha Round. And one of the things we know is across-the-board works. Piecemeal doesn't. So, of course, the dynamic of these negotiations is step one, you negotiate across-the-board tariff reductions. Step two, the industries come back and ask for exemptions. Or if they don't get that, then step three, they go back to their home legislatures and lobby for what are called non-tariff trade barriers, import quotas, which it's tougher to cover. And so it's an ongoing process, which is one of the reasons these institutions never get retired. All right. Now, you've got to throw some challenges at a theory if you're going to have any fun with it at all. And so one what I consider really important challenge to this theory is, well, export taxes. How do you explain that? A superficial view of politics and protection is a hard time with this. Because you don't want to just say, you never want to explain everything by saying, oh, well, I guess those industries in the exporting sector are politically weak, so my theory works. That theory works too well. That theory is so elastic, it can't be rejected, in which case it's not a theory at all. It's Austrian economics. So we don't want to rely on this. So what observable differences between exporting sectors and importing sectors can we look at? Well, again, we think about what export taxes do. Number one, very importantly, they generate revenue. And two, they reduce internal prices. So we ask, is it plausible that this would be an objective of any sensible government? When does this make sense? Well, it makes sense, obviously, when the export sector is so big that it's a large potential source of revenue that just can't be ignored by the government, because otherwise it couldn't collect enough revenue to run its army. And when when the exported items account for a large share of consumers first. So the classic example of this is some relatively less well-off agricultural society that exports a stable commodity that its people also spend a lot of their budgets on. And this is what I consider to be an important feature of a model of politics and tariff setting to explain. Because you know, here in the U.S., we think we have a very tight explanation of why farm interests are politically powerful. We say, well, it's because of the Electoral College. Two senators per state, no matter how many people are there. So if you get a state with a lot of land and not too many people, it's got a lot of relative political power, and that's why farmers are powerful in the U.S. And that's a nice story, except it can't be exported to other countries. And in other countries, we see in Europe, farm interests are very influential, and they don't have an electoral college there. And in other countries, agriculture actually gets taxed. And I think this bottom line is the explanation for that. The differences are in the fundamental economic factors, not the politics. Okay, another challenge to be thrown at this theory is, well, deregulation. You got a tidy theory of regulation, that's nice. You said a few minutes ago, regulators would buffet industry and consumer from price changes. So why would regulators ever go out of business? That's a really important question, I think. And so what we have to look for are external factors affecting political profitability. An example of this near dear to my heart is petitions for railway abandonment, simply because I was once publicly excoriated by the most eminent political scientist of this generation over my humble little paper on this, which just said, basically, as long as railroads are covering operating costs, regulators won't let them abandon their routes because of the harm they've done to consumers. But they will allow them to abandon the routes if things get bad enough. But they won't change the fares. Same thing with airline deregulation. I once went to the trouble of watching what was happening to airline costs in the handful of years before deregulation, and they were rising steadily. And the way I was able to infer this was by looking at what happened to discounts. So in those days, we had just a single airfare on any route set by the Civil Aeronautics Board. So they never changed in response to costs, and that's something that is in the nature of the cost of airlines that I don't think I'm going to go into. But they offered standard discounts as a percent of the stated fare, in particular to people whose trips originated and ended in foreign countries. So tourists from abroad who came to the U.S. got to fly within the U.S. at highly discounted prices. Well, over time, those discounts started to just get smaller and smaller, and they disappeared right around the time of deregulation, which I take as evidence that just the profits to be divvied up just disappeared. And the only way that the airline industries could survive in the face of higher fuel costs was to go to exotic forms of fare setting, such as we have today, which is really just elaborate price discrimination. Okay, another challenge is theory, OSHA regulation. It's very hard to explain why workers would lobby for safety regulation. It seems obvious, but it's not, because it's going to cost the firms money. And the question is, therefore, why would workers want their compensation in the form of safety plus money instead of just not more money? And why do they need a regulator to get this for them? Why can't this just be bargained in just the way that the neighbor bargains with the neighbor's dog? Well, it turns out that we can learn a lot about the politics of regulation from looking at the form this takes. It's never safety regulations that raise firms' costs on a worker-by-worker basis, because that would cause lower wages. It's always point of source regulation, which is a way to basically take some of the income from capital owners and transfer it to workers. Before I get to this one, I mentioned, as far as I'm concerned, the single biggest challenge to this theory I've laid out comes from environmental regulation, because it's easy to find instances of environmental regulation that I personally can't think of a clever explanation for. My favorite one is one I came upon recently, where the city of San Francisco mandated, or they say subsidized, low water flow toilet installation. They paid people $300 for replacing their old toilets with ultra low flow toilets. Not just the 1.6 gallon per flush standard now, but these were, I think, 1.3 or 1.2 gallon per flush toilets. Cost a tremendous amount of money to replace these toilets. And then it turned out that there was insufficient water pressure to move the sludge all the way through the city's pipe system, so that sewage was piling up somewhere around, I think it was around Giant Stadium, I'm not certain. So then the city decided, they tried everything, now they have to dump a bunch of bleach into the bay to take care of the sludge. I total up the approximate cost of this, and it's truly staggering. Hundreds of millions of dollars, when all they had to do to reduce water consumption was, of course, raise the price they were charging for water, which is about a penny a gallon. So without a doubt, the most insane regulation I've ever encountered, and I do not have a tidy explanation. So I find when it comes to the environment, it's much harder for models of rational choice to work for some reason. But in wrapping this up, I want to talk about the political economy of the toxic asset relief program. This one's pretty easy. No problem for our model. This is the moral of the story. It's good to be the home firm of the Secretary of the Treasury. Under President Bush, Secretary of the Treasury Henry Paulson, I'm certain, in all sincerity, decided it was a good idea to let Lehman Brothers go out of business and to prop up Goldman Sachs, and it's just coincidental that he gets millions from Goldman Sachs. I'm sure of that. All right, so in closing, the evolution of popular thinking about the role of the state. This is the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse. Its construction was financed by order of the federal government in 1797, so we know that the founding fathers thought this was a good role of the state because they were still in business then. They were still passing the law. So this is the way people once upon a time thought. This is the extent of government policy convention, and today it's more like this. We don't run the lighthouse, we run the Titanic. Okay, that's pretty much it.